This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. Stay tuned for another look at an excellent series that WMRA's Jordy Yeager produced late last year. We're going to talk about food insecurity in Virginia. But first, it's been known for some time that immune cells and their signals can induce changes in our central nervous systems, or CNS. But the link between the immune system and social behavior was unknown until recently, thanks to new research out of Charlottesville. WMRA's Marguerite Gallerini reports.
Dr. Jonathan Kipnis is the director of the Neuroscience Department and of the Center for Brain Immunology in Glia, BIG for short, at the University of Virginia. He's been looking into the immune system connection with the central nervous system of mice for quite some time.
When I was a graduate student, we started to be interested in the role of immune system in response to injured CNS. And then from there, the question was, is the immune system playing a role in normal CNS?
The CNS is the part of the nervous system mainly consisting of the brain and spinal cord.
And so I started my own lab, which we try to understand what are the exact molecules that the cells produce to affect brain function.
After more than 10 years, they finally discovered that a special disease-fighting molecule called interferon gamma was also responsible for social behavior. Anthony Filiano, a postdoctoral research fellow in Kipnis' team, explains their recent study.
We found that interferon gamma has a pro-social role, and this was really unexpected to us, and it was fascinating.
This was unexpected because the interferon gamma molecule is produced by immune cells, called T cells, themselves produced by the lymphatic system, a crucial part of the immune system. So since it is part of the lymphatic system, so far interferon gamma was only known for its anti-pathogen nature, as Anthony mentioned. That means it was only known for responding to bacteria, viruses, or parasites. So to arrive at the discovery of this other social role, the UVA team studied flies, zebrafish, mice, and rats, and they noticed that when these animals were social, they activated the T cells, releasing interferon gamma.
And we found that mice that are deficient for these immune cells, their brain goes haywire. It's this hyperconnectivity in a part of the brain that's important for social behavior. And so these mice have social deficits, and patients with autism, they also have this hyperconnectivity.
But researchers still didn't know exactly where that interferon gamma was located or coming from. That is when Antoine Louveau, a postdoctoral fellow in the Kipnis lab since 2014, came in.
So when Antoine came to the lab, the question was that he was interested about is to understand where the immune cells that affect the brain are located. And that's when he started to look into meninges more closely.
The meninges are three membranes that envelope the CNS. Louveau explains his research process.
We were able to analyze the meninges as a whole tissue. And when we did that, we realized that the immune cells were very localized at specific spots in the meninges, and they were along those major blood vessels called sinuses. And when we looked very closely at those vessels, we realized that they were lymphatic vessels.
So that is how they made two discoveries at once. Antoine demonstrated a direct link between the brain and the immune system, contrary to decades of thinking that the brain was immune-privileged, that is to say, lacking a direct connection to the immune system. And they found that interferon gamma might affect social behavior. But why are the immune system and social behavior correlated in the first place?
So we created this hypothesis that when organisms become social, they would activate this interferon gamma response pathway to protect against the spread of pathogens while aggregating.
Indeed, many creatures need to interact for the survival of their species, but the same contact also makes the spread of diseases easier. That is why interferon gamma both makes them social while protecting them from diseases that could come from such social interactions. That also explains why deficiencies in the immune system can lead to neurological disorders such as depression, social anxiety, autism spectrum disorder, or frontotemporal dementia.
And our preclinical study in mice showed that interferon gamma is necessary for normal social function. We think that this suggests that perhaps interferon gamma signaling pathway might be a target for these diseases.
But this will require further research in the years to come.
Yeah, so we keep the clinical trials to the experts. It's too early. These studies were just done in mice, and a lot more work needs to be done.
More needs to be done, especially in transitioning the research from mice to humans. But this first step in better understanding the link between social interaction and the immune system is very good news for the fight against neurological diseases stemming from immune deficiency. For WMRA News, I am Marguerite Gallerini.
Lots more about this research if you want to dig into it through a bunch of links in that story at our website. According to Feeding America, an average of about 1 in 10 Virginia residents in the WMRA region are food insecure, meaning they are without reliable access to a sufficient quantity of affordable, nutritious food. Last October, WMRA's Jordy Yeager spent some time exploring the experiences of Virginians struggling with food insecurity and talking to the people and organizations trying to help. We're going to hear again much of that series now, beginning with the work of food pantries. The Blue Ridge Area Food Bank operates a series of mobile food pantries throughout rural Virginia, providing food for thousands of people in hard-to-reach areas. Jordy visited two of these rural pantries.
I arrive at the Effort Baptist Church in Fluvanna County just after sunrise for the monthly mobile food pantry. The truck carrying nearly 10,000 pounds of food isn't scheduled to arrive for another 3 hours at 10 o'clock, but already 11 cars are parked in the top lot. These are the first of the 209 households that the Blue Ridge Area Food Bank will provide with bags of groceries today. By 8:15, there are 20 cars in the lot. By 9:30, 40 cars have arrived and parked. I meet a former UVA cook, a man who worked for the Department of Transportation, an unemployed construction worker. But I want to talk to the folks in the very first car that arrived this morning.
Most time we have to get you a beef here before 5 o'clock.
That's right. 5 a.m. is when 78-year-old Clara Bruce and her husband Horace get to the mobile food pantry in Palmyra. Every month for the past 4 years, they drive about 25 minutes from their country home to ensure they're near the front of the line. Clara brings a blanket for naps and a WordFind puzzle book to pass the time. She used to work at the ComDial telecommunications plant in Charlottesville. Horace used to work as a janitor for Fluvanna County Public Schools. And now, aside from Social Security and a little pension money, they struggle to put decent food on their table. In total, the Blue Ridge Area Food Bank operates 9 mobile food pantries throughout rural central Virginia, serving as many as 5,000 people each month. It began 5 years ago when they realized that thousands of people were going without food because they lived in the countryside.
But we find, too, that especially in rural areas, there aren't a sufficient number of pantries to meet the need. We talk about food deserts.
Michael McKee is the chief executive officer of the Blue Ridge Area Food Bank.
You know, in rural areas, those food deserts are quite large. And then for people without sufficient funds, they could live behind a grocery store and still live in a virtual food desert because they can't afford to go in there and buy anything. So we try to get our mobile pantry into remote rural areas where they don't have access to pantries, or the pantries might be open only once a month or so, to supplement what's available in their communities. Reaching the rural poor is a real challenge because you just can't imagine the barriers to transportation. There are no buses. The car is broken. Where are you going to go? Are you going to rely on some neighbors? Well, there might not be a neighbor with a working car for another couple of miles, right?
Good morning. How are you? Good, thank you.
Everyone knows Katie Harris. She's a partner services coordinator for the Blue Ridge Area Food Bank and oversees 8 mobile food pantries, including the one in Palmyra and the bi-monthly one in Scottsville, where I found her on a recent Tuesday. Harris lets headquarters in Verona know how many people they're expecting for the day. The truck, which can carry up to 15,000 pounds of food, is loaded up, and when it arrives in Scottsville, it's all hands on deck. As few as a dozen to as many as 30 volunteers pull down the fold-out tables, unload hundreds of boxes of food, and get to work. The empty paper bags make their way down an assembly line, getting filled to the brim with groceries, ranging from fresh apples, onions, and zucchini to almond milk and cottage cheese. Families go home with an average of 40 to 50 pounds of food each visit. When all is ready to go, the cars make their way around, one by one, with trunks popped open, as the volunteers fill them with bags of groceries. Though food insecurity rates tend to be lower in rural communities than in cities, for those it affects, it can be more severe. It's often harder to get work and to get to work if you live in the country. Heating costs in the winter are often higher than in urban areas. Childcare is not as accessible, and there's typically only one grocery store for the surrounding area. Many families I spoke with did not want to be recorded. They live in the country, away from cities, and prefer to keep their lives private. And for the most part, unless we interact with these folks, their plight, too, remains hidden. I posed the same question to Harris as I did to the Bruces. What does she think folks would do if the mobile food pantries didn't exist?
I'm not sure. It's tough. Produce-wise, though, I'd like to think that we're able to provide them with something that's trying to, or that's helping them get some more nutritious items into their diets, which are more expensive, I know. I'm not really sure what their other options would be.
One of the most hidden faces of food insecurity is that of the hungry child. Earlier this month, Governor Terry McAuliffe announced that nearly 5 million more school breakfasts were served to Virginia children in the 2015-2016 school year than in the year before, due in part to more access to school breakfast programs through increased state funding last year. Many schools, including those in Charlottesville, are attempting to help kids eat better, more regular meals, and to learn good eating habits, including learning how to grow their own healthy food.
Such a familiar noise. For many of us, it's probably far removed, but that's the sound of about 100 third and fifth graders eating lunch at school. In Albemarle County last year, about 20 of those voices belonged to kids from homes that didn't have adequate access to food. If you lived in Charlottesville, nearly 55 of those 100 children were considered food insecure. And that's just locally. A recent study by Feeding America, a nationwide nonprofit network of food banks, looked at central and western Virginia. They found that in 2013, more than 53,000 kids under the age of 18 weren't sure where they'd get their next meal. That number had grown by more than 1,300 kids since the previous year. Nationally, the group found that nearly one-third of the 49 million people who go hungry in the U.S. every month are children.
Children who are food insecure arrive at school far less prepared to learn.
Michael McKee, the chief executive officer of the Blue Ridge Area Food Bank, explains the effects food insecurity has on children.
They have a much harder time attending to teachers. They might have a harder time staying awake. They're lower energy. They're more easily distracted. They're given to more frequent behavioral challenges. And they're likely to fall behind if not provided with sufficient food. And we know that kids who fall behind by third grade fall further behind and are at higher risk of dropping out of school.
To try and make sure that kids have enough to eat in these formative years, the federal government funds free and reduced lunch programs in schools throughout the country. In order to qualify for free meals, a family of four has to make less than $31,000. Last year, more than half of the 4,000 children enrolled in Charlottesville City schools received free or reduced lunch. That proportion has held steady since 2007, the year before the recession. Of course, some elementary schools in the system have higher rates, well over 80% most years, while others hover in the 30 to 40% range. In total, last year, Charlottesville City Schools provided roughly 375,000 lunches, 200,000 breakfasts, and 60,000 snacks to kids. But it's not just the quantity of meals that a child receives, it's also the quality. So within the sheer volume of food, Christina Connell tries to make sure that food insecure kids eat more healthfully. That means providing students with more fresh fruits and vegetables and fewer processed foods. That means preparing more foods in the school kitchen and ordering fewer frozen foods from a manufacturer. That means getting students to try new things, like kale chips or hummus or parfaits. That means the fryolators of my childhood have been replaced with salad bars. It hasn't been easy, says Connell, a coordinator of school nutrition for Charlottesville City Schools.
At least we're providing these meals that are nutritious, low in sodium, high in whole grains, at least a couple times a day to people that ordinarily wouldn't have that opportunity. And maybe in some way that'll make a difference.
Another way the schools are trying to make a difference is with vegetable gardens, like the one I visit at Clark Elementary, which has the highest free and reduced lunch rate in Charlottesville.
What?
As the kids try new foods like kale chips or asparagus, they also learn where it comes from and what it takes to grow it. The nonprofit group City Schoolyard Garden was started 5 years ago and now boasts educational gardens in 7 out of the 9 Charlottesville City Schools. While nearly every student has a chance to get his or her hands dirty, the group is particularly focused on reaching kids from low-income and food-insecure households. About 2,500 kids participate in the gardens each year, but the program goes beyond teaching kids how to grow kale, asparagus, and dozens of other vegetables. Executive Director Jeanette Abinader explains.
Our vision is that children who are engaged in nature have enhanced academic performance. They cultivate healthy living skills. They learn about community teamwork. So we're using the garden as a lab.
At the other end of the age spectrum, more than 350,000 senior citizens in Virginia have trouble paying their basic costs of living, including meals. In this installment of his look at food insecurity, Jordy hit the road with the Meals on Wheels program in Charlottesville, which provides the retired and the homebound with daily meals and a little human touch.
Oh, is this a one-way street?
No, it's not. No, you're good.
We're good.
I'm riding along with 30-year-old Adam Wright. Wright's an airline pilot by trade, but in his off hours, he delivers food for Charlottesville's Meals on Wheels.
Good morning, Mr. Hare.
Well, thank you.
My pleasure. Have a wonderful day.
You too.
Every day, 5 days a week, Meals on Wheels delivers about 270 meals to people in the Charlottesville area who are homebound or who can't cook for themselves.
Right now, our age group runs from 23 to 96.
Lee Tripp is the executive director of Meals on Wheels in Charlottesville.
The younger ones tend to have some type of debilitating disease or a mental disorder that does not allow them to care for themselves. But this allows them to live independently because they've got somebody to bring them food every day. But 80% of the people that we serve are over 65, and about 65% are over 75. Wow. So it is mostly an elder population. I mean, we're talking about people who were, you know, the librarian in your school, the postal worker who came to your house every day. You know, these are they're people that you saw, and then you don't see them anymore, and you don't think about them, but they're there, and they need us.
The Charlottesville Meals on Wheels was started 38 years ago by 4 women in a church basement. They delivered 8 meals a day. Today, that has grown to 4 part-time staff and a network of 180 volunteers. Each meal costs about $5.50. But because most of their clients are too poor to afford the meals, about 3/4 of the 270 daily meals they deliver are fully subsidized through the private donations they receive from local supporters. Tripp says they don't receive any set government funding. Most of the rest of their clients pay a sliding fee, somewhere between $1 and $4 per meal, depending on their income.
They're choosing, if we don't feed them, they're choosing between buying food and paying for their medicine or paying for their home. That's not a fair choice. Nobody should have to make that choice, especially when you get older. I mean, what can they do otherwise? They can't go back to work.
Today they're serving up potatoes, chicken nuggets, and spinach, perhaps?
A handful of volunteers prepare meals in the basement of the Charlottesville headquarters. They're packed into a series of coolers, which are each labeled with a different route number. On a recent Friday, Adam Wright gets Route 15. He's got a total of 10 deliveries, some of which include meals intended to last clients through the weekend. One of those is Hortensia Cruz.
Ms. Cruz, got some meals for you. You got a minute for a reporter?
Cruz invites me into her small living room, where we sit and talk for half an hour. She lives by herself and has narcolepsy and a rare illness called stiff person syndrome. It causes her to have random seizures because her senses are extraordinarily heightened. Loud noises, bright lights, sudden touches, these can all send her into convulsions. She wears a giant set of ear protectors around her neck, the kind that lumberjacks or construction workers wear.
Yeah, I cannot go to church, to a movie, to a party, concert, nothing. To a reunion, barbecue, because some people talk loud. So I cannot socialize like I wish I could, you know.
Once, she tried to go to the grocery store, but a nearby shopper sneezed loudly. Cruz dropped to the floor as her body began to tense up and spasm. She doesn't know what she'd do without Meals on Wheels. She's scared of cooking for fear that she'd burn her house down if she had a seizure while at the stove. But it's more than just delivering meals to those in need. For many of these folks, this is the only contact they have with another human being throughout the course of the week. Volunteers aren't just delivery drivers. They're also caretakers. Meals on Wheels has emergency contact numbers for everyone they serve. If a volunteer is worried about a client, that number gets called. If they don't answer, the police are there within 30 minutes to check on them.
A couple of times they have had to break in, and they found people on the floor and gotten them to hospitals. Since I've been here, it's all worked out really well.
Knowing they're the only touchstone for many of their clients, Meals on Wheels tries to go one step further, sending birthday and holiday cards to folks as well, reminding them that they're not entirely alone.
I mean, we had one lady called, and she wasn't complaining, but everybody in the office cried over it. She called to tell us that we were the only people in the world who remembered her birthday. And she wasn't doing that to make us feel sorry for her. She was just telling us how appreciative she was that we actually did it. It's hard to think of people being that alone, but they are.
For WMRA News, I'm Jordy Yeager.
And that series by Jordy Yeager won first place from the Virginia Association of Broadcasters for news series in radio. Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bib and Dolly Frazier, Les and Johnny Grady, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, the Just Pax Fund, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of the Community Foundation of Harrisonburg in Rockingham County. If you'd like to learn more about how we fund our news and how you can help, go to WMRA.org, mouse over news, then click on News and Information Fund. Find all of our stories from the newsroom at WMRA.org, and be sure to click like on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio. And you can follow me on Twitter at WMRA News to get the latest on our coverage. I'm Bob Levicki, WMRA's news director and morning edition host. I hope you enjoy the rest of your Sunday. I appreciate you joining us today. I'll talk to you in the morning.